For many, that song is Motown music. Dancing in the Street, written by Mickey Stevenson, Ivy Joe Hunter, and Marvin Gaye, and recorded in two takes, less than 10 minutes, by Martha Reeves. Well, little did they know, after slapping down Martha's vocals in that studio in Hitsville on West Grand Boulevard, that they'd created a song that would come to represent a watershed moment in history, Motown's history, Detroit's history, and America's history. Writer Mark Kurlansky tells us the story of how this hit Motown song became the rallying point for important moments in history. His newest book is called Ready for a Brand New Beat, How Dancing in the Street Became the Anthem for a Changing America. And Mark Kurlansky joins us now. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Nice to be talking to you.
Take us back, if you will, to that day in June 1964. Martha Reeves got on a bus and went from her home on Detroit's east side over to the west side where Hitsville was. And she wasn't even supposed to be recording that day, was she?
No. You know, Berry Gordy built Motown by grabbing all of these talented kids out of high school. And it should be remembered that the only reason this was possible because this was a day in which high schools, public high schools in poor urban neighborhoods had great music programs, most of which have been cut now.
Yes.
So kids got out of high school, if they had musical talent, you know, they not only knew how to sing or play instruments, but they could read music, they understood music theory, they understood how harmony worked, and they would try to, you know, somehow get a foot in at Hitsville, Motown, and they'd go over to the studio, and you know, if you hung out there, good things happened. You know, sooner or later, this is how Diane Ross got her start. You know, someday somebody's going to say, "Hey, you try this."
Yeah.
And you know, she was over there just doing what the young talent did over there, and she heard that Marvin Gaye was recording a new song called Dancing in the Street. And she didn't think much of that title. She told me that she would have much rather done a song about dancing in an elegant ballroom. I mean, that's Martha, you know.
Yes, we know her. So she hears about, you know, Marvin's in the studio, and she had a little crush on him anyway, didn't she?
I think she always had a crush on him, and she started singing backup for him. So she went into Studio A there to see what he was up to. And Marvin Gaye saw her and said to Mickey Stevenson, "Hey, why don't we let Martha do this?" Just like that, you know. And you know, 50 years later, Martha still remembers this as the moment when Marvin Gaye handed her the song.
Wow.
That wasn't it at all. That was happening.
What was happening?
The three of them had written the song in the home of Mickey Stevenson and his wife,
Kim Weston.
And the song was for Kim. And they always used to make a demo tape for the artist to listen to for a while before their recording session. And they were just there trying to make a demo tape. And it occurred to Marvin Gaye that a demo tape for Kim with Martha singing would be a lot better than with him singing. Because it wasn't really his kind of thing. I mean, he wrote it, but it wasn't the kind of song that he sang.
Right.
But then after she sang it, she just so nailed it that they just couldn't imagine anybody else singing it, which was, of course, a huge problem for Mickey Stevenson, who had promised it to his wife.
And she really nailed it in two takes, correct? One, they said they weren't rolling, although that's not
this
real
was
clear.
Another thing that they never told her.
Yeah.
So I was sitting in Martha's old house in the living room there on the east side, and she's sitting to the right of me, and Ivy Joe Hunter is sitting to my left, and we're talking about this, and she's telling me this old story that she's told 100 times that everybody knows about how she sang it, and then they told her that they messed up and failed to record it, so she had to sing it again. So I sort of asked the obvious question. You know, I used to be a reporter. You know? the question that sort of hangs there is which take was better, you know, because the other take is lost now. So I wondered, you know, was that really a you know, did we miss the really great one? And she was starting to answer, and then I hear Ivy over to my left say, look at me. I turn around, and he says, you've got this young artist, and she does this take, and you think, well, it's not quite there. She can do better than that. So do you say that, or do you say, oh, gee, I'm sorry, I didn't record it. Can we do it again?
How to handle an artist.
And Martha, you know, her jaw dropped open. Nobody had ever told her that. She had always believed the story that, you know, it hadn't been recorded.
That's a great story. You know, you explain in your book, Ready for a Brand New Beat, how the rhythm and blues of the 50s was really targeted at black audiences. And before that, black music had come out of slavery. And as you point out, Mark, whites had swing, blacks had R&B. Now, take us up to that summer of 64 and give us a sense, what was the position of black music and black artists in that summer?
Yeah, so, you know, the bulk of the African-American population of the United States was rural and southern. And then in the first part of the 20th century, they started moving north. And by mid-century, the bulk of the population was northern and urban. So that, of course, changed the music. So instead of having rural blues and gospel, you had a music with a much harder beat, electric instruments, and it was called rhythm and blues. And rhythm and blues was black music.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, black music and white music were completely separate, made by different people, different record companies, sold in different record stores, played on different radio stations with different DJs, and, you know, so different that Billboard charts had a black chart and a white chart.
Right.
The black chart was called the R&B chart. That's what R&B meant. And then, you know, this idea started emerging of integration. And a lot of white people, obviously not all, but a lot of white people, especially young white people, thought this was a pretty great idea. And those young white people, the white people who were interested in the idea of integration, very logically started getting interested in black culture. That meant black music. And they started listening to R&B. And then, of course, you had, you know, rebellious, bad white boys from the South who went to the wrong side of town and learned the music and learned the vocalization and the clothes and the dance moves. And, you know, and you get Elvis Presley and
Jerry Lee Lewis.
Right.
Yes.
And so, you know, now there's a white R&B world, and Alan Freed, the great promoter of rock and roll, originally a Cleveland DJ and then New York, invented the term rock and roll because he didn't like it. It was sort of a problem. If you said rhythm and blues, it meant music for black people.
Mm-hmm.
So rock and roll meant R&B for white people. And, of course, this was all very interesting for people like Barry Gordy, black people in the music industry, because the white market was about eight times the size of the black market.
A lot of money to be made.
Yeah.
By the time we're looking at that summer in 64, you had that whole issue of the British invasion and all these Brits who had grown up worshiping black R&B artists.
You know, with all of this controversy and trouble that people got into, rock and roll hit a period when it was said to be dead. It actually wasn't dead. I mean, there were actually a number of really great performers, but it wasn't as hot as it had been in the 50s. And it was in that period that the British started taking up the slack. They had loved the old rock and roll, and you know, people like the Beatles and Mick Jagger and, you know, said, well, what's happened? It sort of died. So they started doing it. And, 1964 was the year that both the Beatles and Rolling Stones first came to America.
Yes.
And really, the only thing, if you look at the charts in those days, they were completely dominated by either British groups or Motown.
They were. I remember vividly from I've kept the music guides from the station I listened to as I grew up here in Detroit. I'm speaking with writer Mark Kurlansky, whose book, Ready for a Brand New Beat, How Dancing in the Street Became the Anthem for a Changing America, looking at that hit, Martha and the Vandellas' Motown song, and how it became the rallying point for some very important moments in history. When you talk about that summer of 64 and then the year or so after as that song just became a giant hit, Give us a sense, a snapshot of what was happening politically and socially in America, because it just was, it's mind-boggling when you look back and realize.
It is. I have an appendix in the back of the book just listing what happened in the summer of 64. It's unbelievable. I mean, the song came out July 31st. 2 days later, the Vietnam War officially began. The first of hundreds of black inner-city uprisings took place in Harlem a couple of weeks before the song.
The Civil Rights Act was passed?
It was the heart of the Mississippi Freedom Summer.
Yes.
And, Goodman and Cheney and Schwarmer had disappeared, and mm-hmm. the front page of the paper every day was about the search for their bodies. It was a presidential election year, and people forget how important an election year it was. Goldwater Johnson completely changed the nature of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and the nature of American politics. You know, that whole red state, blue state map completely changed in 64. Mm-hmm. So it was an extremely significant summer politically. But, you know, one of the big changes was these uprisings that started to happen every summer in every urban area with an important black community.
We got ours in Detroit in 1967.
Absolutely. In 1967, yeah, I mean, Detroit was one of the big ones. But, you know, there were 120 of them just in the summer of 1967. And, you know, here is this song that says, you know, first it has this very strong black voice, this trumpet call and the strong voice saying, calling out around the world.
Yeah.
And are you ready for a brand new beat? Summer is here, and the time is right for dancing in the streets. What's that supposed to mean? And then they're dancing in Chicago, and it starts listing all of these cities which had large, volatile black communities. And by the way, Marvin Gaye was the one who did the list, except for Detroit.
Hmm.
He was listing all the cities, and Ivy Joe Hunter said, "Hey, don't forget the Motor City."
And that went
into the song exactly like that. Don't forget the Motor City.
But Martha always insisted, didn't she, that that song was about a street party and having a good time. And so who began?
Absolutely, and I have no doubt that to her it was.
Okay, what about to the writers? What about to Stevenson and Marvin Gaye and
Well,
and
you know,
Hunter?
Gaye would have been interesting. He of course, died years ago, killed by his father.
Yes.
But, you know, Gaye was very political, and he's the one who, for years, had this argument with Berry Gordy, his brother-in-law, saying that, you know, Motown can't just be about love and heartache. We've got to take on these issues. These are important issues, and we're going to be irrelevant if we don't take them on.
So was this a case of what was often something that happened in black music called masking?
Well, quite possibly. You know, this was a very old, strong tradition in black music, so much so that, you know, when black people hear a song, the first thing they do is try to figure out what the real meaning is.
Yeah, yeah.
And Mickey Stevenson told me that the origin of the song was he was driving around in Detroit one day with Marvin Gaye, and they saw a bunch of kids, black and white, playing in, this was in the summertime on a hot day, and they were playing with a fire hydrant. And to him, this song was about integration.
Hmm.
So Mickey Stevenson did see a political meaning to the song, although not the one that's usually ascribed to it. So it's, you know, it's very difficult. And also, don't forget that the whole concept of masking, the whole tradition of masking is that you never admit it. You know,
That's true.
You know, like follow the drinking gourd. You don't say, yes, this was actually about the Underground Railroad and escaping to the North. You know?
Sure.
So we might never know. But, you know, clearly in talking to Mickey Stevenson, I had the impression that, you know, there certainly were intended political undercurrents. But
and it's worth noting, isn't it, that after 9/11, broadcasting giant Clear Channel put Dancing in the Streets on a list of songs its radio stations, many of them, should not play.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? 2001, and it was still considered a dangerous song to play at a difficult moment.
Yeah, I do remember that. So how is Martha, as you talk with her, or Mickey, how are they about the fact that that song has come to embody the spirit of revolution for blacks, and then later for women in the early 70s.
Yeah, Sarah Dash, who sang it with Patti LaBelle and Laura Nyro, said that, you know, as far as she was concerned, it was a song about emerging feminism. But I kind of got the feeling that Mickey Stevenson liked all this. Martha does not. Dating back to 1967, even before that at Watts, you know, that they used to say that this song was inspiring, you know, was causing people to riot. This, of course, was white people saying this.
Sure.
And, you know, it was a kind of a racist thing that, you know, black people just sit around in their lackadaisical way, but then along comes the song, and then they go out on the street and start burning down buildings. It's an absurd concept. But, you know, there were a lot of people who genuinely believed that, you know, this song inspired people to riot. And this was pretty upsetting to Martha, who doesn't like violence. And she was asked at a press conference in 67 if she had inspired the Detroit and Newark riots. And she still almost comes to tears when she talks about it. You know, she doesn't want to be held responsible for these things.
What drew you to this song? What made you go to all of this and dig into this and write this book?
Well, it was a great opportunity to get at a few things I wanted to talk about that don't get talked about enough. One being how the struggle for black rights completely changed American music. And, you know, it would have been totally different without it. There wouldn't have been rock and roll without it.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that it shows the importance of a song. You know, this song was one of 50 songs that's in the U.S. National Archive of great songs that are iconic to American culture. And, you know, it shows, partly by, you know, just enduring, it shows the importance of a song. Songs tell us all about who we are, what we came from, and what we aspire to be. And I thought this was a great time to think about that.
The book is Ready for a Brand New Beat, How Dancing in the Street Became the Anthem for a Changing America. And I've been speaking with the author, Mark Kurlansky. Thanks so much for your time today, Mark.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.